Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Can a little bit of money really make a difference in the life of somebody poor? Consider this, an amount that seems like a pittance to middle-class Americans might be just enough to start a woman in the developing world on the road from crushing poverty to financial stability. The 2006 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to a man named Muhammad Yunus and to the Grameen Bank that he founded in 1983. The organization provided small amounts of credit, microfinancing, often under $100, to poor Bangladeshis looking to start small businesses. Today, that model has spread around the world, involving partner agencies and encouraging independent but like-minded practitioners like the Grameen Foundation USA, founded in 1997 by my guest, Alex Counts. Counts grew fascinated with the Grameen model when he was still a college student and contacted Yunus to offer his help. He was inspired by watching the program in action, first in Bangladesh, later in the struggling neighborhoods of Chicago's South Side. Counts writes about what he learned and the people whose dreams microfinance has changed in his book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, How Nobel Prize Winner Muhammad Yunus and Microfinance Are Changing the World. Alex, welcome to Think.
It's great to be on.
Can you talk about your first contact with Dr. Yunus? Because I guess he wasn't convinced that you would work out in Bangladesh.
Well, this was just a little over 20 years ago when I was studying in college, and one of my professors had said something that's kind of startled me. He said that every major problem in the world has been solved somewhere, but usually on a very small scale. And so I wrote Dr. Yunus a letter with all the naivete that a 19-year-old you'd expect from, and I said, I'd like to come work with you and spread what you're doing in Bangladesh, which at that point was already pretty successful around the world. And he wrote back, encouraged me, but, you know, I think he'd seen a lot of young people come to Bangladesh very idealistic, and at the first realization that learning the language was tough, or the diseases that you'd get, the food difference, that most of them would leave very quickly. So he didn't want to get his expectations up or mine, but I ended up working with him for 6 years just loving the experience, and that's what led to the Grameen Foundation.
Tell me what you found when you went to Bangladesh.
Well, what I did, the first trip I took with him, and I recount this at the beginning of my book, is I went out with him, and they went to some celebrations observing the anniversary of the founding of Grameen Branches. So Grameen Branches, like a bank branch office, a small office, five people that serve maybe 2,000 or 3,000 borrowers in the neighboring villages. And there were poor people, but they were in this big celebratory mode, and there were childrens doing skits, and I thought I was going to get the City of Joy and the empty rice bowls and the bloated stomachs, and I'd certainly see some of that over my 6 years. But what I saw was people who'd gotten a leg up on poverty were moving in the right direction and were just thrilled to see him, obviously. And then the next phases of my training were really about figuring out how they'd done this, how they had got banking to the scale of a poor person and did it in a business-like way, because I wanted to ultimately apply it elsewhere, even in inner-city Dallas, Texas. And what he said to me, to really understand it, you have to interview a poor woman in the kind of depth as if you're going to write a full-length biography on her, because we that are brought up in privilege have so many myths about the poor and their capabilities and their liabilities that to break through that, you have to go extremely deep. And every loan officer in Grameen, and I modeled my training on them, has to do one of these case studies. And it's just eye-opening because the poor have many more capabilities, untapped though they may be, than we imagine. And that's really the secret to Grameen.
And a lot of these businesses, although they're simple in nature to begin with, really scale much larger businesses. There are stories, for example, of people who recognize that they have to take a loss certain months of the year because their cost for raw materials goes up, but they understand that and they fulfill their contracts. They really become quite sophisticated.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the stories in the book is this woman, Noni Bala Ghosh, who had been brought up in a family that made different types of sweets and cottage cheese from milk, yet they'd given that up. They didn't have enough capital to have such a business, and with a loan from Grameen, that the first one was $40, they got back into this business, and ultimately they had contracts with sweet shops that sell, sweets, candies of various kinds, Bangladeshi type sweets, in as far away as Dhaka, 100 miles, and they would be able to know, even though she'd never gone to school a day in her life, if the price of milk went up by 5 cents, she knew exactly what that would mean for her business and could manage her cash flow accordingly. So you meet her before she joins Grameen, you think it's just one of these hopeless poverty cases, and yet with an injection of capital and the peer accountability structure that's within Grameen, that next thing you know, she's a thriving entrepreneur with a business that is, spans, across the country in terms of her client base.
Forgive me for oversimplifying here, but in some ways, when these businesses begin, the way the money is used almost sounds a little bit like that story of the elves and the shoemaker. You know, the elves make one pair of shoes, the shoemaker sells them and suddenly has enough money to buy enough leather for two pairs. Can you talk about the typical growth rate for investment in a microfinance client?
Yeah, what you find is, I mean, first, your point is exactly right that that when the money starts circulating the economy, when the economic activity grows, it kind of feeds on itself. And a lot of the things that people make are bought and sold by other poor people or middle-class people. And so when the overall activity, and that's why Grameen goes in and tries to pick out 40, 80, 100 people over time in a village, finance their businesses. And also it tends to benefit even the wealthy who aren't eligible for Grameen type of borrowing because they're too wealthy, but they see, again, the activity, whatever they produce or sell, there's more activity. I'd say broadly speaking, there are Grameen borrowers, and we see this in Dallas with the Plan Fund that I sit on the board of, that's a local version of Grameen Bank, is that, a certain percentage of the borrowers kind of stabilize in a business that maybe they started with a loan in Bangladesh of $50, and they grow, and they stabilize at $300 loan, and that's about the capital they need. And this is not really getting them way above the poverty line, but it's enough surplus to feed their children, put their children through school. You're not that vulnerable anymore. Then there's another class of clients who are the true entrepreneurs who, if they'd been born into privilege, they might be the Bill Gates or the Ross Perot or the Michael Dell. And for them, their growth rate often can be 50% plus per year for 10 years running. And they go from having two chickens to a royally whole poultry farm. They might have 500, 800 chickens. And this is the case where they're starting to generate employment for others, really boosting the local economy, and they get far over the poverty line. And both of them, both are contributing to the reduction of poverty and inequality. And again, I think that cuts across cultures. But I don't think I've always argued that not the way to look at that. If those dynamic ones are maybe 20%, it doesn't mean you have an 80% failure rate, as one Time magazine interviewing me concluded, but rather you have some super success stories, but you also have others who reach a kind of a stable subsistence that is a huge change from where the people started.
Alex Counts is my guest. He's president and CEO of the nonprofit Grameen Foundation, which is a global network of 46 microfinance partners in 25 countries. He'll be in town on Thursday, September 4th, to speak at an event sponsored by the Chiapas Project and the Plan Fund that takes place at SMU. You can find details about that on our website, the think page of KERA.org. I want to talk a little bit about, there may not be an 80% failure rate, but there are critics of the idea of microfinance who say, for most people, rather than lifting them out of poverty, it simply makes poverty more bearable. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I don't think it's, I mean, first of all, in business, no one is forced to join a microlending program. In business, and if you're in a capitalist economy, some people will do better than others. Some will not succeed. Some will actually suffer a setback. You can do all that you can to mitigate that, to create support structures, but that is true. So from the super success case to the woman who invested, her cow died, and she's worse off than she was before, I've seen those cases. What I would say is that it is a very kind of a ultimately a patronizing and to not have a touch with the reality of poverty to say to someone that you've gone from one meal a day and occasionally during the year no meals a day to two meals a day. They may not be good, great quality meals. And as a result of that, your children don't have the stunting that you get from that. That their IQ is 10 or 20 points higher. They're able to achieve in school, maybe not go to university, but they go to college. So you know that's. I think you have to look at this in a multi-generational context, and say that the person for whom poverty is more tolerable is also the person that's more likely to. Not concerned with their day-to-day survival, can really invest in that next generation, and that next generation can really break the bonds of poverty. And that's what I saw, which is I saw people who were not that much better off, but where they put their profits were hiring literally private tutors for their children so they could pass the exams in Bangladesh, go to university, because the public schools are very low quality. And so that's, I think you have to look in that perspective. And if you do, you see even the cases that look modestly successful, you jump a generation, and it's a totally different story. Again, you've broken that generations upon generations going back hundreds, if not thousands, of years of poverty. You've broken that. If it doesn't happen in the single generation, it happens in the next one.
Let's talk about the gap between people who are able to qualify for microfinance loans and those who can actually get a loan from a bank. How wide is that gap, and are there efforts to narrow it?
Well, right. This is, it varies a lot by country. The rural banks in Bangladesh, at least up till when I lived there 10 years ago, they were not interested in anything except the totally upper crust of the business and individual banking customers. So there was a huge gap. There was the middle class wasn't served. In other countries, Mexico, for example, there is real competition and some pretty good products for the middle class. And what's happening is as the bankers of the world are seeing now a market opportunity to go lower to really go and take off the best performing microfinance clients. They're expanding what they think their market is, which is I think a very healthy thing. Now, we've been trying to make sure this is Grameen Foundation and our local support organization called the Chiapas Project, who's been working with us in Latin America, to entice the banks to partner with MFIs that really have mastered how to provide financial services to the poor, and let the banks be kind of the wholesale lenders, the financiers of these specialized lending organizations, rather than compete with them in an area that they would probably have to significantly change their operating procedures to do it effectively. But again, it varies a lot by market, but there is that gap between where microfinance stops and where the banking sector leaves off at the top is in most countries narrowing, and I think that's a very healthy thing. In Bangladesh, most women in Bangladesh have options of borrowing from 2 to 3 different banks or MFIs, and this allows them to have real choice.
My guest is Alex Counts. He's president and CEO of the nonprofit Grameen Foundation. He's written a book called Small Loans, Big Dreams, How Nobel Prize Winner Muhammad Yunus and Microfinance Are Changing the World. We'll talk more after the break, including make some comparisons between what's happening in Bangladesh and what's happened in inner city Chicago. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about microfinance and its benefits with Alex Counts. He's president and CEO of the nonprofit Grameen Foundation. He will be in town September 4th for an address at SMU that is sponsored by the Chiapas Project and the Plan Fund. You can find information about the appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I think we've talked a little bit about developing countries and the benefits of microfinance there. Many people in this country and in other developed places would imagine that a small amount of money wouldn't really make a difference here. But in fact, the model has scaled very well to urban areas.
It has. When I was writing doing the initial research for my book, I spent a lot of time on the south side of Chicago, as you mentioned, and I saw a real world in the inner city of problems, but also vibrancy that I had no knowledge of growing up with the background I did in New York City. And I saw a real opening for, as I later would see in Dallas and New York and other cities, for microlending for people who often lacked a formal education, and in the workforce they would be targeted for the lowest paying jobs, the last hired, first fired. And yet they had that entrepreneurial spark, though they didn't have the education that is so important in the workforce. And provided with $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, they might start a home-based daycare center that could scale, a beauty parlor, a landscaping business, a photography business, desktop publishing, various different things that, again, could range from a supplemental income that would patch together what they had from part-time jobs to a thriving business where they might be employing a half dozen people.
And initially, when the idea was proposed in some of these neighborhoods, the people who were targeted as potential clients didn't trust anybody coming in and saying, how would you like me to lend you $1,000 for a business? They were suspicious.
Well, it remarkably like rural Bangladesh, actually, which really surprised and amused me that people came in and particularly if it wasn't a government program, and people think about those in different ways, but if it was a private program, whether for-profit or non-profit, they're saying, well, what's the angle? Are you going to try to, is this you're trying to convert me to your religion? Is this you're trying to, what's the catch? Because the idea of actually an organization taking a risk with the basic kind of oil thing that oils our economy, money, working capital, to put it into an unproven, small, tiny startup business just was very foreign to people. But ultimately, you know, just like in Bangladesh, when you find a few risk takers who come out and the whole community watches what happens to them, and if there is some catch, and when they see it happening, they say, wow, we can do at least as well as that, and this is legitimate, and you can earn the trust of people in low-income neighborhoods if you stick with it. And next thing you know, you have groups springing up all over the place, and then you get those economies of scale where, you know, people, like one of the things was, one of the businesses someone did in Chicago was making, among other things, business cards. Well, when people aren't in business, they don't need business cards. But when other people are, then she had a business serving in part the other clients of the Full Circle Fund. So it kind of feeds on itself. But you have to be patient. You have to earn people's trust. But in the end, there is that entrepreneurial but uneducated or undereducated by the standards of our society. And some working capital and a supportive structure can sometimes work real miracles.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Alex Counts. Let's speak to Matt in Frisco. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. First of all, I was born in the country, so I totally understand what Alex is explaining this whole process. So the fact behind this whole idea that we don't understand is this. The microfinancing is not just giving money to individual. I think it is another way to create and bring individual up a level of thinking process, as well empowering others. So by empowering others means that here you have $100 and you're giving them money, and then their entrepreneurial spirit goes higher. So that's when you see a result, and most of the time you see a result in a positive way. So I think which is a great thing. And another observation that I observe in here is this. Having no education here and having no money here is the same process in Bangladesh. I mean, it's the same way of thinking, same way of understanding. So if you don't have education here or money here, that means that you're going to go through the same process just like in Bangladesh. So the process is that we just have to understand that how we can empowering individual with microfinancing and what we can do to create a movement. And I think that's what we have to do here in inner city in Dallas or Chicago or anywhere else in the United States. So,
Matt, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. There's a real element here of both, you know, the money is the working capital for the business, but it's also a vote of confidence in the person, and it helps them discover abilities that they didn't even know they had. And again, I've seen that magic unfold, and in the depressed neighborhoods of Dallas, like I've seen it in Bangladesh, all of us, many of us who are achievers, and in different ways, we can look back to a moment where someone, maybe a parent, maybe a mentor, a teacher, gave us a vote of confidence, and it changed how we looked at ourselves. Well, this loan of $1,000 in Dallas, $100 in Bangladesh, has that same effect, and again, you're giving them the basic tool of our capitalist economy, which is capital.
Now, I know that one of the big ideological debates in all of this, because now there are private entities and for-profit entities that are providing microfinancing, as well as not-for-profit corporations and foundations, is the question as to whether ultimately this is to benefit the investor or the person who is taking out the loan. Can you talk about whether there's a middle ground?
Sure. I believe there is. In fact, I wrote an article that your listeners could see. It's in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, where I tried to get beyond this debate. I first of all think that whether an organization is technically a for-profit or non-profit is not that relevant to what it's doing in microfinance. There are many for-profit microfinance organizations that are creating that limit the profits for the investors by choice, and also have really rigorous ways of making sure that the poor borrowers are benefiting, and there are other nonprofits that really pay short shrift to that. But the question for me is, and I think the middle ground is, investors should be able to make money in microfinance where the market allows it, but they should really do it with a long-term perspective, where they're saying, I may earn marginal profits while people are still living in poverty, and if we're successful in our microlending and they get out of poverty and I earn their trust and they want to do business with me when they're above the poverty line, that's where I'll earn the big profits. And that will take time, but that's a really sustainable business. It's new business. It's not just trying to – it's creating new actors in the economy who are generating wealth for themselves and for banks and investors. There are other categories of people that I think are just trying to extract a short-term profit that kind of start veering into consumer lending, so lending to – for people not for productive purposes, but for consumption purposes, where they get into over-indebted, and it's the version of the subprime crisis played out in rural villages across the world. So it's, when I think about it, is are we talking a long-term, real win-win business strategy with the poor winning as central to it, or is this a kind of short-term speculation on the part of microlenders to enrich investors? And you have both things going on. And one of the things we're trying to do in Grameen Foundation is to create some sort of transparency and a kind of a lexicon, a terminology for understanding whether people are doing this with a social purpose, where everyone wins, or really it's a profit-maximizing business where the poor might benefit, but they might just as well not. They might even slip behind and get into debt they can't handle.
Would you like to see governments underwriting these kinds of loans?
Generally speaking, in many economic areas, including microlending, I think that if the government can play the role of rule setter, of figuring out how to make a regulatory framework that is conducive to microfinance and protects all the key stakeholders in it, but allows for innovation. That's the key role. When governments get involved in direct lending to the poor, it's almost always a disaster. People, they don't have the discipline of the private sector, and they tend to muddy the waters, and people think of it as patronage, that loans that frankly don't need to be paid back. Governments, in some cases, have been financiers of early-stage microfinance organizations, provided them some seed capital, and a few of those, some of those funds, one in Morocco in particular, another one in Bangladesh, that have been managed or set up by the government, they've done a good job because they're financing those who are, whether for-profit or non-profit, who really study the poor and their needs and do it in a private sector way. So, and governments have a role to play, but it's largely as setting rules. And again, there's, you know, a number of countries have really gotten it right, how to be supportive of microfinance sector, and really it's not that complicated to study and apply it, but most governments haven't done that yet. And that's another objective of Grameen Foundation. We finance individual loans for the poor through our local partners, but we're also trying to really change the game so that whole sectors can thrive through trying to change policies and the way governments look at microlending.
Alex Counts is president and CEO of the nonprofit Grameen Foundation. It's a global network of microfinance partners in 25 countries. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next to Orlando in Dallas. Hi, Orlando.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
I have kind of like a two-part question. The first part is, one, not being the biggest, you know, or the most astute person within American business, but what I do know is a lot of times in America, it's usually investors want to go for short-term, 3 to 5 years. And, you know, I know in the 80s and 90s, one of the biggest problems that you couldn't get American investors to invest with an outlook of actually making any returns on something 10 or 20 years down the road. Long-term investment was not really the model for American business. So one of the questions is, how do you really work to really sell long-term? Because I keep hearing, how do you really work to sell that to investors, particularly in the microfinance arena? And then two, what are your recommendations when an individual, where to go if an individual is it needs like $1,000 to $3,000 to start a business, has a good idea, but really doesn't really have an idea of where to go to get somebody who's going to truly trust them, doesn't have a whole bunch of financial background and you know, a whole lot of assets to show a financier that, hey, I'm, you know, I have this strong financial stable background that I need $3,000 to really get this idea off the ground.
Yeah. Let me take the second question first. Thank you for calling in and raising those two. The plan fund that is, again, I serve on the board of since its establishment, and you can through the station's website, or you can go to planfund.org, find out about. They do lending. They've been doing lending since 1999 in Dallas, in the kind of amounts that you're talking about, $1,000 to $3,000. Most of the loans are in that range, and like in Bangladesh, they. To borrow, you need to be part of a supportive group. In Bangladesh, it's almost all women, and the men are in their own segregated male-only groups. In Dallas, it's a mixed gender. It's a different kind of cultural dynamic here, and we found that that works well. So there's also other microlenders. There's Axion, Texas is a presence in Dallas, and there are others beyond that. So, but again, those are the two that I'm most familiar with. In terms of having, you know, I think the argument we've made with banks is that, you know, is that how you've defined your business up till now is you and your competitors are just fighting over the top, 20 or 50% of the businesses and families in the country, and you just keep trading them back among yourselves, and you know, they're really diminishing profit margins there. Now you may have a good market share now, but you may lose it. I said, if you take a long-term approach, you can actually develop a whole part of the market that you've written off, you never even considered, can become a vibrant source of new profits, and you'll have that market to yourself for a time. And if you can build up loyalty within this new entrance, you will have a strong competitive advantage. And if you do it ethically with a long-term perspective, you won't be seen as exploiting the poor, but you'll be seen as partnering with them and in developing this new new market, I must say that many of the banks are taking this kind of approach. The first one that did it on a global scale was Citibank, and under a wonderful man named Bob Anibali, who's a friend of one of our board members, and he's been studying this for a while. He was asked by the leadership of Citigroup to develop a global business, and really with a time horizon that I think they're thinking more in decades. And it's been successful. Now other banks, Deutsche Bank, a lot of the international banks are developing these groups, and they're I think beginning to realize that redefining and expanding the definition of what a client can be, and leveraging the fact that there are micro lenders out there that understand this market. So how do you partner with them? Is a gaining currency and. Because people realize that if you write off a third or half or two-thirds of humanity and the businesses in the world, you're missing something big. And when all your competitors have done it, that means also there's a big opportunity for you. So that's what we've been making. And I think there's also big public relations risk for the banks, especially after this whole subprime crisis, of going in there and making irresponsible loans with a short-term objective with low-income people, whether here or overseas. That's not only hurts your profits and doesn't really build sustainable relationships, but it can actually hurt you in the eyes of investors and the public and the media.
And we should say that for the most part, there's a lot more sort of face time between a microloan borrower and the lender than there would be with a traditional kind of loan.
That's right. Typically, a woman in Bangladesh, and it's similar to this in Dallas with the plan fund, is a woman and her group will meet the microlending organization for about an hour every week or every 2 weeks. And that's an opportunity to do business, to learn things from your peers, and even to learn new information about healthcare and social services that can also improve your life.
Alex Counts is with us. He's president and CEO of the Grameen Foundation. He will be in town September 4th for an address at SMU that's sponsored by the Chiapas Project and the Plan Fund. You can find information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@KERA.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Alex Counts is with us. He's president and CEO of the Grameen Foundation. He's got a book out called Small Loans, Big Dreams, How Nobel Prize Winner Muhammad Yunus and Microfinance Are Changing the World. If you want to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. We should say, Alex, that this book that you put out this year is actually an updated version of one that you wrote over a decade ago.
Yeah.
You went back and sort of followed up on certain things. Can you talk about the changes that took you most by surprise?
Well, the book has the original book of these kind of timeless stories of microlending that, you know, just happened in two very different places, Chicago and Bangladesh. When the Nobel Peace Prize was announced, I immediately thought that these stories were important to be back in circulation. But then I looked and saw we should tell people what's happened in 10 years in microfinance. And one of the things that happened was the Grameen Foundation was created, and many other microlending organizations have been established to take this banner forward, this torch forward, if you will. And the proliferation of it, how it had become something that was arguably only really successful in two countries, Bangladesh and Bolivia, and through a global campaign and a lot of effort of many people's parts, it had now taken root in dozens of countries. That really surprised me. And the other thing that surprised me was that it had been an area where many people had become involved as volunteers, as financial contributors. It had become really a citizens' movement, a civil society movement. The Chiapas Project, which is co-sponsoring my talk, has become involved in championing our work in Latin America, taken six trips to Chiapas, Mexico, and other places in in the region to support and learn about microlending and to form lifelong relationships with poor women and the people that work for the microlending organizations. And the last thing that really struck me was that because the relationships that these microfinance organizations like Grameen had built with the poor, it became opportunities building on that trust to bring them information about modern health practices, about the value of education, of good sanitation, and that actually had a way to change some of the myths and the unhealthy practices that the poor have. Of course, even rich people have unhealthy practices. It's not something limited to the poor, but it became a way to convey useful information and breakthrough ideas to the poor through a channel that never existed before. And that had really been built out globally, and I think the potential for that to address poverty in the next decade is enormous. So I tried to tell the stories of Grameen Foundation and organizations like that, how this really movement had grown from a very limited thing to something that was global in scope and perhaps the most significant organization of poor people in world history.
You mentioned education and the importance of healthful living. There are 16 decisions that I guess people, particularly in Bangladesh, who have taken these microfinance loans from Grameen, pledged to make in their own lives. Can you talk a little bit about them in general?
Well, this is why, you know, we talk about microlending being a means but not an end. The end is people living healthy lives and lives free of economic hardship. And when some early borrowers in Bangladesh just started in a workshop articulating what that life was like that they were aspiring to, they wrote it down and they said, well, let's not just aspire to them, let's decide to realize that. And they just listed 16, and those became the 16 decisions. And borrowers said that we should all memorize these, and any new borrower should memorize them when they join. You're not thrown out of the bank if you don't realize them, but it becomes a kind of code that people start asking about. In Bangladesh, one of the things they decide to do is to send their children to school, and another thing they decide to do is not engage in child marriage and to not give dowry, which tends to devalue the women and young girls of marrying age. And so they start asking, are you doing it? Are you paying dowry? Are you marrying off your children young? Are you keeping them from school? So there begins a kind of a competition, a kind of an awareness that even spreads outside of Grameen. In a place like Dallas, the issues aren't so much dowry, but the issue of drugs and keeping and just having and it just creates a way for people to talk about, you know, how are you doing keeping your children out of gangs and drugs and some of the social problems in this culture that are very different from Bangladesh. And so it helps weave into the DNA of microfinance that we're doing finance, but we're doing it for a purpose, which is to improve people's lives. And these codes, these decisions, tend to capture that. In Dallas some years ago, I sat with 40 borrowers who designed their 11 guiding principles, I think they called them, that were very similar in some ways, very different in others than what was in Bangladesh, but it was an expression of the lives they wanted to create, and it was very clear that microlending was going to be part of how they were going to get there.
An email from Christine asks, is there a website or resource that reports on the performance of these organizations? I've never really found anything that does a comparison on which the most responsible or successful.
Well, it's a great question. There's an industry resource called The Mix, which stands for Microfinance Information Exchange, MIX, themix.org, and that really focuses on the performance benchmarking, particularly in terms of financial performance and profitability of MFIs. We've just launched a website that you can access through grameenfoundation.org, and this website is called Progress Out of Poverty. If you just Google that, you'll find it. That is beginning to get at how do you benchmark not just simply the process indicators of is an organization making a lot of loans, but is it transforming lives? And where it's certainly a work in progress, but we feel that is going to become increasingly important. So progressoutofpoverty.org and themix.org are probably the two best websites that you can look at and start to evaluate on multiple grounds who are the best performers in a given region.
That's going to be a real challenge to develop those metrics, because you're not just looking at who repays and how quickly the money comes back, but you also have to sort of measure against what improvements are made in people's lives and in sort of the shape of their own finances.
That's right, but there's really been some breakthrough thinking in this area, because you know the academic study of you know who's out of poverty, and it takes years and years of data collection. It can be quite exact, but you know oftentimes the published article comes out 10 years after the data is collected. We've developed something called the Progress Out of Poverty Index, which is modeled on in several respects something that Dr. Yunus developed in Bangladesh, and it looks at some questions that are easily observable and verifiable that are highly correlated with, in a given culture, with whether someone is in extreme poverty, moderate poverty, or out of poverty. And the questions vary, but just to give you an example, one of the things that's fairly common among them is, you know, what do people invest in when they start to get a little surplus? Well, number one, they repair their roof because they don't want to be rained on. Two, they put in good floor, so their feet aren't in the mud when they come out of bed in the morning, and their children. And the third, as it happens, if another human need, I guess, that's evolved, is people buy a black and white television, and they want to be entertained. So they want to get out of the elements, out of the mud, and they want to be entertained. And those seem to be highly correlated. And when you can put together that questionnaire that can be filled out in 5 or 10 minutes per borrower, it gives you some very interesting data about who in microlending, who's being more effective in transforming lives and who's being less effective, and that hopefully will guide both philanthropic and social investor resources to those that are doing the best at it.
I want to talk for a minute about the interest rates, because they are typically much higher than those for other kinds of loans, many times 40% or even more. And that's in part because of the cost of administering each and every one of these. Can you explain why the interest rates are so high?
Sure, and there's a big range. I mean, there are heavily subsidized programs and government programs they'll exclude, but ranges can, you know, be from 15% and 20%, which is where Grameen is at, to as high as 40-50% plus in some cases. Of course, where inflation is high, that's just a break even. You need to be charging a lot. So again, you have to see it in its proper context. But the reality is that microfinance organizations, that there's relatively little philanthropy going into microfinance compared to the need. So a lot of these organizations, what they lend to the poor, they have to borrow themselves most of it. Now, the Chiapas Project in Dallas has allowed used resources in creative ways to decrease the cost of capital to microfinance organizations in Latin America. But in many cases, they're borrowing at 15%. So just the cost of the money that you're lending to the poor, that's first thing you have to do is pay off your bankers. Then you're providing this door-to-door service, and oftentimes these organizations are not are very relatively small size. They haven't gotten the resources they need to get to an optimal size, and yet if they don't have a lot of philanthropic support, they need to break even. So they need to pass on the inefficiency of their smallness to the poor, and that's where you get the high rates. I will say that in this organization in Chiapas, Mexico, that the Chiapas Project has been supporting, when they started, the support and the kind of collaboration with these women in Dallas, led by Lucy Billingsley and others, that they were 3,000 borrowers, and they just weren't generating enough surplus from their lending, and so they had to have raise their interest rate. Well, now they're at almost 20,000 borrowers in Chiapas, the poorest state in Mexico. They've been able to lower their interest rate and lower their cost of capital. And so really it's about scaling these organizations and giving them a capital at a reasonable cost. And that's why the largest organizations in the world, like Grameen Bank, have the ones that have really scaled in their market have the lowest interest rates. Grameen charges interest rates from 20%, housing loans at 8%, student loans at 5%. And they've been able to do that because they've had the capital to grow. And so that's what we're trying to do with the Grameen Foundation, is to get these organizations to the right size where they can serve a lot of people which has its own benefits, but also it allows them to spread their management costs and gain the efficiencies of large scale, and then the poor don't have to pay for the inefficiency of these tiny organizations, which is often the case now.
I probably should have done this earlier in the hour, but it is a little bit confusing, I think, for people. The difference between, for example, Grameen Foundation, which is your organization, and Grameen Bank. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. And it's even more confusing than that because there are a lot of Grameen organizations springing up who are carrying the torch. But simply put, Grameen Bank is a lending organization working directly with the poor in Bangladesh, in a single country. And they've done a fantastic job and shown what's possible. Grameen Foundation was set up with the support of the founder of Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus. In fact, he was the original donor to it, gave us a small amount of money. And what we're trying to do is enable the next generation of Grameen banks in these 25 countries. So we don't work directly with the poor, but we work with the organizations like Al Sol in Chiapas, Mexico, that are the very small versions of the Grameen Bank, and we want to help them grow and become as successful in Mexico or the Dominican Republic or Haiti or Nigeria as Grameen has been in Bangladesh. So we're trying to globalize this. And what I can take some satisfaction is that this very kind of simple vision that I had as a 19-year-old that I wrote Dr. Yunus with to help him take this model on a global scale. That's really what I did as my career with Grameen Foundation, and with the support of many generous donors and volunteers, to take that torch forward across the world, outside the borders of Bangladesh, because it was something that was not unique to that country, but had really global applicability.
How much bigger, Alex, does it need to get? I mean, would you like to see Grameen Foundation 10 times larger than it is now?
Well, what I'd like to do, you know, when we set a goal 5 years ago, which was to increase the outreach to the poor of the women we worked with from 1 million to 6 million borrowers, an increase of 5 million, and people thought it was crazy. And we've actually reached that goal 9 months early, that 5-month goal. And yet, in the grand scheme of things, where you have 200 to 300 million families living on less than a dollar a day in extreme poverty, it's just scratching the surface. So, you know, we've in Grameen Foundation, where we've mobilized now about $20 million a year. I think we would know exactly what we could do if we were 5 or 10 times bigger than we are, and the demand is there. The delivery channel is there, and we're just looking to take advantage of it and to keep growing it more than it is.
Alex Counts is president and CEO of the Grameen Foundation. You can find out about his September 4th appearance in Dallas on the Think page of KERA.org. The book is called Small Loans, Big Dreams. Alex, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.